I'd like to remind all Coast to Coast listeners about Paranormal Date. It is here. ParanormalDate.com was created by George Norrie and Mark Rowlings for the single person in our paranormal world. The site is now mobile optimized, and it's completely free to join. Check it out today. Just go to ParanormalDate.com. Use the promo code George. That's ParanormalDate.com. Tonight, Ron Felber is with us. His new book is The Mojave Incident. It is the true story of Elise and Tom Gifford, who were abducted out in the Mojave Desert, not too far from the Coast to Coast studios. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Follow me right now on Twitter. If you have any questions for myself or Ron Felber tonight, it is live to my left at J Church Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'll be back right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Ron Felber is a graduate of Georgetown University, where he received his BA, Loyola University, where he received his master's degree, and Drew University, where he received his doctorate. Ron has published 8 novels, including the Jack Madsen series, A Man of Interminate Value, and The Kafka Society, and 4 nonfiction books, including Il Dottore, The Double Life of a Mafia Doctor, which was the basis for the Fox primetime television series, The Mob Doctor. Mr. Felber was a deputy sheriff transporting federal prisoners after graduating college. Those experiences were used for some of his early nonfiction articles written for the iconic True Detective magazine. His latest book is The Mojave Incident. It's the true story of Elise and Tom Gifford, who claimed to have been abducted by extraterrestrials during a desert camping trip not too far from the Coast to Coast studios. I would like to welcome to Coast AM, Ron Felber. Ron, are you there, sir?
I am, Jimmy. Good to be here.
Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to start here with all of your True Detective and that type of writing. And then this story comes to you, which we'll talk about in just a bit about how that happened. But this was a first for you. And what was it like to write a book about E.T. and abductions?
I think it showed me that the world really doesn't operate the way we think it does, that there's a lot more out there, that things are much more connected than we realize, and that a lot of things that we think are coincidences are not coincidences, and that and there's a kind of curtain that occasionally opens up and people see a greater world, another universe, maybe a parallel existence. But clearly, what we see in front of us and what most people take to be reality is anything but.
This case, for the fans of this type of writing or investigation, for that matter, this case is something that most out there haven't heard of yet, but yet it occurred. It goes back, it starts in 1989, 1990, 91, 92, and that's quite a bit ago. What separates this case from all of the other ones that are more mainstream, if I can think of something else, a better way to put it?
Yeah, I think, you know, this has been described as the most frightening UFO book ever written. And I guess, you know, some people can look at it that way, but I would look at it as probably the broadest, the most detailed and specific, and with duration. You've got two individuals, a husband and a wife. These are, you know, upwardly mobile college graduates with a couple of kids. You know, the last thing in the world they wanted was to have a UFO alien abduction experience, but they did. And, it was 8 hours of conscious exposure and 4 hours that were recovered later through retrogressive hypnosis.
Was it an easy book to write?
It wasn't. It really wasn't, because it's so broad. It would be sort of like taking somebody that had never been to a city and putting them, in the middle of Manhattan. They'd see, you know, buses and taxis and high rises and then say, okay, fine, describe that.
What struck you, Ron, about Elise and Tom, about their integrity for you when you first sat down? Because you're dealing with the fantastical. You're dealing with something that most people just can't relate to.
Yeah.
And so what hit you about their integrity?
I think that these were just really credible people, people that were almost like wounded psychologically from an experience that, you know, I took them to see Dr. Bernard Vitone, who's the director of the National Center for Psychiatric Disorders in Washington, D.C. And he described them as suffering from the symptoms of POWs, you know, insomnia, sexual dysfunction, you know, paranoia, just really rattled to the core by this experience, an experience they didn't really want to talk about. And Jimmy, you know, what I looked at was, you know, when you hear somebody sort of bragging about war stories, maybe in a bar, the first thing that comes to my mind is probably it isn't true. Because the people that really saw combat in the Gulf War or Vietnam or wherever, they don't talk about it. And that's what impressed me about the Giffords. These were not, you know, loudmouth braggarts or anything like that. They were very, very subdued, very almost embarrassed by the experience. This was a story they didn't really want to tell.
And with your background, not only in law enforcement, but, you know, detective work, were you able to apply your BS detector and look straight into their eyes and determine if somebody was being factual and telling the truth?
Yeah, I very much so. You know, at the time, I had a couple of kids and young kids and, you know, wife that was a homemaker. And so we didn't have tons of money or anything like that. But I made a point of flying the Giffords to Washington, D.C., where they were examined by Bernard Vitone, Dr. Bernard Vitone, and then to Asheville, North Carolina, where they were retrogressed by Dr. William Annixter, at the Mountain Center of Psychiatry, who works with the FBI with you know, terrorist victims or rape victims who've been traumatized and need to recall detail, let's say, for, you know, to find the assailant. So we flew them there, and again, this was at my expense, and it wasn't like we had a lot of money, but I said, if I'm going to do this, you know, we're going to do it right and to the best of my ability anyway.
I want to back up. Let's just back up for a second.
Sure.
How did this case, because it's just not a known case. How did you find out about them? And was it, well, let's start there.
Okay. I have a business background, so I was running a company, and it wasn't a sort of a mid-sized company these days, I guess, a couple $100 million though, and a large sales force. So one of the salespeople that we had in California became a friend of mine. So we'd have dinner when I was on the West Coast or he was on the East Coast. We would have dinner and whatnot, and we became pretty good friends. So he knew about my writing and enjoyed that. And I knew that he was a former varsity football player for the University of Redlands, and just a very capable, intelligent guy and a friend. So he said, you know, I have a best friend that I played football with, who was All-State, and had an incredible experience that I think you should write about, and I'd like to introduce you to. It's he and his wife. They don't want to talk about this. They buried this deep inside. But I think it would be healthy if they told you their story and if you could document it, because it's the most incredible story I've ever heard. And this particular fellow, this mutual friend, was one of the very, very few people they confided in outside of their parents.
Had you, at that point, familiarized yourself at all with ufology or other abduction cases, or was this completely new to you?
At that time, it was completely new to me. It just, you know, I'd heard, again, vaguely about Betty and Barney Hill. I never read the book, or I've read it since, but at that time, I hadn't read it. I've heard about it, and of course, you know, Life magazine had photographs going back to the late 50s of, you know, these grainy photographs of UFOs. So really, that was the extent of my view of the topic. And actually, even from my side, when I first then heard what it was about, I told our mutual friend, look, you know, I write biographies, occasionally I write business articles, and you know, I write spy novels, because I like thrillers and whatnot. It's just, this just isn't something that's of great interest. No, no, once you meet these people, once you hear the depth and breadth of this story, this is a story that needs to be told, and you'll want to help convince them, and it will be good for them in the end. And so one of the things I think ultimately that was alluring to Tom and Elise Gifford was that I would take them to Washington, D.C. to be examined and to take tests for neurosis, for psychosis, for brain lesions, things of that nature. And then beyond that, to find the missing time that really plagues them in their dreams as nightmares.
Now, before you went to Washington, D.C., after your friend informed you about the couple and the potential of getting involved in this, then you sat down and you met with Tom and Elise. And tell me about that first time that you sat down with them.
Well, I mean, I have to say it was a little bit awkward. And we didn't really talk about their experience. We talked more about their kids, our kids, their kids. My wife was with me at the time. And so it was a very natural sort of course of discussion where I think they realized that we were not there to exploit them and that we were genuinely interested in the story. And I think they formed a kind of trust, let's say.
And how was this about a year after the abduction, after the incident?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was their memory at that point, were they still, were they discussing this in fresh memory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was like something that if you took a branding iron and put it on somebody's brain, that's what it's like.
And okay, so now you guys go to Washington, D.C., and I think at this point you must have had remained skeptical on this. I mean, were you hoping that the results in Washington, D.C. were going to be positive, or in the back of your mind were you hoping maybe that this story wasn't real? Because if it's real, it's very dangerous and it has implications.
You know, that's true on a larger scale. On a smaller scale and individually for them, believe it or not, I think they were hoping that one of these medical doctors, psychiatrists, would come up with an alternate explanation that fit, you know, that filled the bill so that they could sort of release themselves from what happened. You know, an alternate, a counter explanation. Well, it could have been this or it could have been that made sense, but that isn't what happened. And as a matter of fact, both doctors, were very firm in their final summaries. Dr. Vitone called this highly unusual, traumatizing event outside the realm of normal human experience. Dr. Anixter called it the most compelling case of its kind that I've ever encountered. And the interesting thing, because, you know, you always look again, as you say, sort of a police background. So, I wouldn't let Dr. Anixter, after the retrogressive hypnosis sessions, off the hook, you know, because it's very easy for people to sort of get wishy-washy. So I said, so what is your opinion? What is your professional opinion? So he went through, like Dr. Vitone did, the possibility of drugs. And that was eliminated for the simple reason that if they took LSD, let's say, which is not in their character, but let's just say that happened, or they took peyote or something, Tom would have one set of experiences and Elise would have another because it would come from their subconscious. But what happened was when they were in this camper surrounded by these aliens, and we'll get to that, they were actually pinching themselves and saying, do you see, tell me exactly what you see, moment to moment. You know, they were comparing notes on every detail of what they saw. So we put that to the side, and Anixter said, look, looking at all the possibilities, the only one that really fits is that what they say happened to them, happened to them.
If they were both taking drugs of some kind, they wouldn't necessarily, share the same hallucination or share the same dream.
Both doctors called that impossible.
And what about a military exercise? What was the questions about that? Could they have witnessed some top secret black ops out in the Mojave Desert?
That is the first thing that occurred to me. And I even looked at it, because as we'll get into it, they talk about red eyes, glowing objects dropping to the ground, et cetera. You could, put a scenario together where maybe an hallucinogen was dropped, but again, you'd have to eliminate the fact that they were pinching each other and saw exactly the same things. But I think Tom said it best, because the first thing he thought was that it was a military operation, maybe for Desert Storm or something, and they were caught in the middle of it. But then he said, it was too massive even for that. The craft, the ultimate mothership that they saw, very similar to the one that Fife Symington, the governor of Arizona, saw with his son during the Phoenix Light episode, was bigger than a football field. I mean, you're talking about something that's city blocks large. So no one, neither Elise nor Tom, believed anything like that, like a floating city, could fly.
What about at that point, did you try to contact or look into any activities in the Mojave Desert around that time? And were there other sightings in the local media?
Not that we could uncover. And I have to say, I really focused on them. And maybe that would be something of a flaw in my investigative technique, in that I really focused on them, their mental stability, their credibility, and I didn't contact the Air Force, for example.
So you go down the checklist. It's not a military exercise. It's not hallucinogens. It's not their imagination. It wasn't a bad dream. You go down this checklist, and at the bottom of the checklist, the only thing that was left was an alien abduction and a close encounter of the fourth or fifth kind. Is that kind of how it went?
It is, but I think we also had to eliminate, and again, if you met them, you would never think this, but some, people that haven't would say, well, maybe they're crazy. But we took that out of the equation also. I mean, they had a full medical examination, so it wasn't like they're neurotic. It wasn't like they were prone to fantasy or anything of that nature, so even that one was eliminated.
Now, if you were going to, appear in court, right, and you're in front of a judge, and you've got one piece of evidence that you're going to push forward on behalf of the Giffords, and you've got one shot at it, what's that one piece of evidence that you push across the table?
Well, I would say, the easiest is the transcripts from the hypnotic sessions, but even more compelling than that would be the videotapes or the audio tapes, because literally, Elise, when she's talking, it's in a staccato, almost robotic voice, using words that are so precise and so spot on that even though, again, she's a college graduate, intelligent woman, et cetera, this was a kind of English that was like nothing I've ever heard.
Now, it's always about the evidence in any case. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you have a videotape of the regression, correct?
Yes.
You have the testimony of the two doctors.
Yep.
And will Tom and Elise come forward at any point and speak publicly?
I don't think so. I think the doctors are probably very accessible. I don't think that's an issue. But I think that, these are people with children at this point, several children at various ages. And I think that the fellow has a career. I just don't think that they want that kind of exposure.
Now, with the two doctors, one in Asheville and Vitone in Washington, D.C., are they worried about their reputations at all? Are they willing to go on the record?
I think they have been. They are on the record. they're very much on the record already. But if you're asking me, would they consent to an interview? My thought would be yes, sure they would.
It's an absolutely fascinating story. I just want our listeners to know that there are cases like this that come along. I have read the book. I've read it twice now in 2 weeks. It is absolutely compelling and comprehensive. And more with Ron Felber and the Mojave Incident when we come back. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Follow me on Twitter right now, at J Church Radio. Any questions for myself or Ron, hit me to my left. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. And the bumper music tonight, we walked into the studio and started talking about Donnie Darko and the soundtrack to that. And me and the guys just sat around and we just decided to go with this mood. And it's amazing, isn't it? And I wanted to say happy birthday to my father-in-law. To everybody out there, today we had his party. 84 years old. And his gift was a laptop. It was replacing the other laptop that he burned out his video card on. And let me tell you something. There is nothing like somebody that's 84 years old and surfing the web and YouTube for old nostalgic stuff. And he is a whiz. And he was so happy. Happy birthday, Pops. It was absolutely amazing. Moving on, what is a Coast Insider? A Coast Insider is a fan of all things curious and unexplained. Coast Insiders get an all-access pass to exclusive C2C content, including current events, conspiracy theories, paranormal phenomena, alien abduction, and much, much more. Become an insider today and sign up at Coast to Coast AM and browse the last 5 years of show archives, all for just 15 cents a day. Who's a Coast Insider? I'm a Coast Insider. This is Jimmy Church. We'll be back more with Ron Felber right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Follow me tonight, right now on Twitter, at J Church Radio. Any questions for myself or Ron Felber, you can just hit me. Twitter is live to my left. This case, the Mojave Incident, this case, as it turns out, when you read the book, it's a situation where you think it has reached its conclusion. You think you're at that point, and then it goes somewhere else, and it goes deeper and further. But the most amazing part about the book is it's not like any other case that you've read about or heard about before. There isn't that it's just not there. And that is what is intriguing about the Mojave Incident. And so tonight we are going to go through it all. We're going to start at the beginning and we're going to work our way through to the end and the conclusion of this incident that happened right here, just a few short miles, well, about 30 or 40 from the Coast to Coast studios. Ron, let's go back to 1989 and let's start there. They plan a little vacation and they have to work things out with their children, make plans, get a vehicle, a camper, and head out. So take us back to La Mirada and the events of that day before they hit the road.
Sure. I think, you know, if you've had young kids, you know how it can be for young moms. I mean, they're with two children, let's say 2 and 5, that kind of age. So they want to get out. You know, as my wife used to say, you know, I want to be with adults. So she was sort of antsy that way and wanted to go out and go to a place where they could dance and listen to some live music, et cetera. Counter to that really was Tom, her husband, who the season before had missed a shot at a mule deer in the Mojave Desert. And so he had a father who was a hunter and a brother who was a hunter who was with him. And they gave him quite a relentless hard time about missing the shot. Now, here's a football player, varsity football player, all-state football player, pretty competitive guy. I guess the last thing in the world he wants is his father and brother making fun of his marksmanship. So they had two different views of what would happen. They decided to compromise. And the idea was that he would take Elise to Whiskey Pete, which is a sort of a nightclub place with live music and gambling over the Nevada border. Then they would go on a short distance into the Mojave Desert where he would do his hunting the next day or two. So they'd both get what they wanted. Their parents were watching the kids they'd head back and everyone would be happy. Well, what happened was that when they did go to Whiskey Pete's and left for Mid Hills campsite, and this was very unusual, and this is what I'd meant about coincidence, the campsite was completely full, which then compelled Tom to say, hey, look, I know this desert like the back of my hand. I've been coming here since I was a kid with my father, even though it's dark and this is very rough terrain. Let's take the camper in. We'll go into the desert and we'll cook up a couple steaks. I'll make a fire and, and we'll just move ahead and sleep in the camper. So they were a bit derailed right from the beginning, Jimmy.
And the camper is self-contained. They've got a bed, they've got stoves, they got lanterns, they've got everything that they need there. So there wasn't a necessity to stay at the campground. What you have at the campground is other campers. So, but they don't need the campground. So they take off and they head through to a secluded place. And that's where they choose to stop. But they don't need electric. They don't need anything, do they?
Yeah, that's correct. And, this is a very interesting area, the Mojave generally, but particularly this area, which is, very near Sima Dome. And Sima Dome is the most perfect natural sphere in the world. And also this area with Tabletop Mountain, the New York Mountains, in that basin, companies like Alumax mine rare earths like cerium and lanthanum. So a lot of these things are used for laser weaponry, for example. So it's a very eerie, volcanic sort of, terrain, very rough.
Were they familiar with some of the Indian legend or the other sightings that go on out there all the time? You have black projects and secret aircraft and so forth. Lockheed Skunk Works is close by. Area 51 is not too much further away. China Lake, the naval installation is there. And there's strange things in the sky every single night in the Mojave. Were they familiar with that? And at this point, was there anything strange that was going on in the skies?
Well, I think that certainly Tom would be familiar with that. But as far as Elise, probably not so much. So when they get there, it's absolutely desolate. And, it's a clear night, a clear, crisp night. And basically, they start roasting marshmallows. And oddly, and this is the kind of detail that makes this so credible to me, is there are these kangaroo rats and whatnot. And they think it's kind of comical. So they're throwing bread out, and these sort of squirrel-like creatures are taking the bread and scampering away. Then all of a sudden, everything stops. And, the desert at night is pretty noisy, but everything stops. There's no sound. Everything recedes. And so it's an eerie feeling. There's a campfire that Tom has started, and he glances over his right shoulder to a mountain, and he sees a UFO, maybe 30 feet in diameter, right there staring down at him. And, of course, it sends a terrible shiver down his spine. He's paralyzed. And then it goes back behind the mountain, almost like a game. Now, Tom had a UFO experience when he was 8 years old. He was fishing with a friend, and he had an object that they saw in the sky. They felt like it was following them. They dropped their fishing poles and ran. They had some missing time. He really never talked about it much. But when that incident happened, it really freaked him out. I mean, it really tore through him. Now, his wife, of course, never wanted to be in the desert by herself, just the two of them anyway, and was pretty nervous about it. Because aside from maybe, military exercises, this was also an area where motorcycle gangs might, be trafficking drugs and things of that nature. So she was more concerned about that sort of thing. He buries that, doesn't want to talk about it with her, doesn't want to make her more uncomfortable than she already is, but he's terrified.
So there's a definite sense at that moment, and you spell it out really clearly in the book. She's trying to do small talk to keep her mind off of this situation, being alone out in the middle of the desert. And he's thinking about the object he just saw. And so his mind is somewhere else, but yet he's trying to be comforting to her at the same time. So this thing was going down between them, and neither of them really knew what was actually on the other person's mind, did they?
Yeah, exactly so. So actually, he tries to put this behind him as best he can and play the cool role for her mostly. And they're roasting marshmallows and stargazing. And again, this is a guy, who was fairly intelligent and pretty well-read. And so he's looking at the different constellations and identifying them and so this and that. And this is a double star, and this is how double stars work. And his wife looks out and says, well, if that's a double star, this must be a triple star, sort of a half joke. And they both look at this glowing object that's larger and brighter than any of the other stars. And as soon as they see the one, they, in the blink of an eye, there's eight more. So now there's nine. They look at the nine and he says, well, maybe they're weather balloons, which, you know, probably the most inane, explanation, or maybe it's the military craft. They're always experimenting and stuff around here. So she says, I don't know, look. And now these nine objects form a sprawling M configuration on the horizon and start communicating or seem to be blinking lights to one another in a kind of code or communication. So now he's really sort of beside himself, panicked. She's getting really panicked. And now there are hundreds of shining objects that mask the sky. And they start dropping to the ground. Now, they know the terrain is so rough that no wheeled vehicle could be charging at them the way these things are. But what comes out of these objects when they fall are creatures, and the creatures have red eyes. And what they see coming at them as these things are landing to the ground are what they describe as thousands of pairs of glowing, shining red eyes.
Now, Ron, let me jump in here for a second for the audience. I want everybody to understand at this moment what is going on. It looks almost like fireworks or something. The sparks, these bright objects, of which there are hundreds, maybe thousands, are floating now down to the surface of the desert. And they are astounded by this. They could be little craft or something that these creatures are coming out of. Could be the creatures themselves, we don't know, but it's like a fireworks show, and it's shimmering down to the surface of the desert. And at that point, what they see on each one of these shiny objects, it turns out to have a pair of red eyes. So now if you are looking at hundreds, if not maybe 1,000 objects out there, now you're looking at 2,000 eyes looking back at you and heading towards you. Take us to what happens next, Ron.
Well, Elise says, it's the Russians. We're being invaded by the Russians. Now, again, how much, logic. But again, this is what makes it, this kind of detail is what makes it so credible to me, because I guess that's what you would say. I mean, what else could it be? We're being invaded. It must be the Russians or the Chinese, or this is something massive and something, an onslaught. So Tom runs to the back of the camper. He gets his shotgun. He has two shotguns, a Remington and a Browning. He gets the Browning. He has a loop of ammunition around his chest, and he's ready to start shooting. All of a sudden, she gets these telepathic messages that are very pervasive. And it's that, you know, basically don't try to harm us, don't act aggressively, or we will kill you. Put the gun down, get in the back of the camper, and sit there. And she tells him, she grabs him, don't you hear what they're saying? Don't you hear? And he does now. And like in a daze or hypnotized, they walk into the back into the camper, sit there Indian style next to one another, the shotgun across his lap, two gray stumps almost, I can't think of a better word, or bolts almost, like a fire hydrants, that are electrified, keep them in there. So that if Tom try and he tries to he's furious, tries to get out again, these things come forward to an equal measure. So if he goes a foot forward, they go a foot forward, and they're electrified. So he gets jolted a couple of times, and he realizes they're not getting out of the camper.
The two sentries, if you will, they're sitting there at the campsite. They're facing the back of the pickup truck, and they're almost robotic, aren't they? And that, which is menacing. You know, they don't have any emotions or anything. Their job is to make sure that they stay where they are. And Tom and Elise figure that out very quickly.
Absolutely. And this is where, again, the detail becomes, he's furious, you know. He wants to defend his camper. He feels violated, so he's angry. But now they start to realize that this is something so strange and bizarre that an incredible thing is happening in their lives. They look up and they see a huge craft. And what I mentioned about Fife Symington, the governor of Arizona, talking about something that was city blocks in width and breadth, this is what they're talking about, a UFO, the mothership, that literally, he says, caps the valley. And there are six smaller craft hinged under it that are sort of miniature versions of the mother craft. A huge beam with a diameter perhaps of 200, 300 feet, that kind of diameter, shoots down and starts sucking things up, transporting in and out. In the meantime, and this is what, again, makes it so like a veil lifting to another reality, there's what they call a searcher. It's a triangular sort of vehicle that's like a drilling device. And suddenly they smell like burning rubber, sulfur, this terrible heavy odor. And they get the very specific impression that this searcher is mining, because it's picking things up out of the ground, and it's combing the desert bases, searching for something. They think minerals. And this huge craft is hovering above them. And in the meantime, the beings with red eyes, so there are really, you know, a couple of different kinds of beings. The beings that were with red eyes, they call them gremlins. This is the word they use. But these are sort of malevolent creatures, like dwarves with red eyes, leather faces, leather-type faces. It seems that they take glee almost in the horror. The more agitated the Giffords become, the more agitated they become. And around the camper suddenly appear nine illuminated figures. And these are described very in great detail by both of them. But again, spindly, large heads, raven black eyes, totally illuminated, maybe 5 feet, 5 feet four in height, an underdeveloped torso, let's say like a 3 or 4 year old, and long spindly appendages. And they start to deliver like telepathic messages. They start to experiment on the Giffords. They start to pull, like with a syringe, the emotions out of their head and evoke terror, fear, of a variety of emotions, like testing them as you would test perhaps a laboratory animal.
Let me jump in right there. And just to recap, the Giffords are now surrounded by hundreds, maybe a thousand little gremlins with red eyes surrounding the camper. They have a craft that is descending in front of them. Other crafts have strung down onto the surface of the desert, and things are getting terrifying, and they can't do anything because they have a couple of guards right outside the back gate of their camper. This is Coast to Coast AM. Turn down the lights. The rest of the Giffords story with Ron Felber when we come back right after this. Stay with us.